hope, resurrection in the face of death.
If I can just vent a bit here.
The question is, what is right in the sight of God?
Church is essential to being a human.
Yes, 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 yes. It's time for another episode of Irreverend with me, the Reverend Jamie Franklin. We're taking the red pill, going down the rabbit hole with all of our friends, all of our dear listeners. And of course, as always, it is the man, the legend, growing his beard back, and rightly so. It is the Reverend TJ Pelham. Tom, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Jamie. It's been, you know, quite variable kind of weather-wise, but I've been having a good day so far. I think, although my son has had his vaccination, so he is very grumpy.
Nobody can accuse you of being an anti-vaxxer, Tom. With me, I'm not so sure. But it's good to hear that you're well. Sorry about the weather where you are, but I hope that inside you are full of warmth and happy today.
Always full of warmth inside, Jamie. Always full of warmth inside. And joy.
You are, yeah, actually. You're a person, Tom. You're remarkably steady in your emotions. I would say that. We complement each other very well. You know, yeah. Not. I hasten to add, not because I'm very steady, but because I'm completely the opposite. You know, I'm very, very up and down, very emotional. I've got a kind of Latin streak in me, I think. Not that I am actually, you know, that I'm not actually Latin, but, you know, I just identify with those people. Do you know what I mean?
That's all right. I think, are you allowed to do that? I think you're allowed to do that. So you're sort of identifying as Italian, maybe Southern, well, Italian.
Yeah, I might be. It might be appropriation, though. So I should probably take that back. I'm on dangerous territory. Dangerous, very dangerous. Let's move away from that quickly and introduce our other co-host. As well, not as always, frequently joining us, and we're delighted to say he's joining us again. It is, of course, Daniel French. Daniel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Yeah. I think, like Tom, weather's a bit rubbish last couple of days, which is a shame.
Yeah.
We're doing fine.
Yeah, it's cold here. It's cold.
You can tell this is a British podcast, can't you? Because we always start by talking about the weather, yeah. Which I think is great, actually. It's, you know, it's, well, a sign of...
Yeah. I mean, it makes people feel comfortable, doesn't it? But it's always as a kind of prelude to something really, really deep and intense. So people need a little...
Biscuit, cereal.
Oh yeah,
honestly, cereal, the weather.
That biscuit thing infuriated people. So,
biscuits.
Honestly,
eating because I ate it the wrong way up. So my wife got very upset with me. Anyway, we shouldn't talk about that.
Either people were saying that your comments were ridiculous, Tom, or they were saying, "Why are you talking about biscuits when there are so many?" You know, basically, the whole of Western civilization is falling apart. Yeah, I'm sorry, Tom. I'm going to get to some feedback about some of the things you said, which have been really positive, but there hasn't been much positive feedback about your...
Do you know what, Jamie? I identify with the hobbits in Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you ever remember the scene where Theoden comes into the ruined Isengard,
yeah,
and Gandalf, and he starts chatting to Merry and Pippin.
Yeah.
And Gandalf says, "You do not know what peril you're in, Theoden. These hobbits will sit on the edge of ruin and talk about table niceties and family, yes, members to the ninth degree." You know, maybe there's a little bit of a hobbit in me, although I'm 6'6", so not very much of a hobbit.
I was going to say, you're probably the human being that least resembles the hobbits that I've ever met. So, you know, maybe sort of emotionally or psychologically you're a bit like them, but you're actually... You're more like one of the enormous characters in Lord of the Rings. Maybe even, am I going to say this? Maybe even an Aragorn, Tom. I don't know how good you are with a sword, but you're certainly a tall, strapping young lad who could, you know, potentially... You've got the potential anyway to be a great warrior. You probably need some training and to hit the gym a bit. But I'll give you that one, Tom. I'll be nice to you and give you that one. Right, so introductions have been done. And now I think what we need to do is say a massive thank you to everyone who's joined our Patreon community. It's wonderful to have people joining and to be with us there. Tom and Daniel are on the Patreon community now. You've become patrons yourselves, haven't you, Tom and Daniel, which is wonderful.
Yes.
So you can chat with all three of us online. And it is genuinely a really good place to come if you want to connect with others in a more focused way. It also supports us financially, and you can become a patron of the show for as little as £3 a month and join everyone else up there. I'm starting to post the audio of the podcast up early now, so you get the podcast a bit early, and also put lots of posts up.
So I understand that you get the option to name the podcast, don't you, Jamie?
Yes, that's a new feature. That's a new feature which I thought of last week. When I put the podcast up on either Wednesday or Thursday, I'm going to ask the patrons to name the podcast. So the one last week, which was Solace, Hope and Even Joy, which was something you said, Tom, that was somebody's suggestion. So you can actually win the competition, name the podcast. Oh. So that's another feature of becoming a patron. But if you'd like to become a patron of the show, you just need to go to patreon.com/irreverent, and then you can become a patron too, or a patron too, I should say. Now, we've got too many patrons to give proper shout outs to everyone, but I'm gradually going through this list. So I'm going to give a big shout out to 20 more of our patrons, and then there'll be another 50 left, but then more will come in this week. So hopefully at some stage we'll get to the end of this list. But here we go. So a massive thank you to all new patrons: Martin S, Joel, Lisa, Ricardo P, Tom, Fiona W, Skeptic Nurse, Jane K, Beth S, Louisa J, Liz E, Pete K, Steve M, Domine J, Charlotte, I don't know why I find this so hard, Charlotte F, Leslie B, Matthew R, Andrew S, Rachel, Ian A, and Joy Wilson. And as I say, there are another 50 people who we have not yet named, but they will be named, and it will happen. So thanks to everyone for becoming patrons, and do join if you'd like to, and support us and join that online community. All right, chaps, I think we should start with a bit of scripture, if you boys are happy with that. Ooh. And this time, yeah. I'm going to introduce this this bit of scripture. And I think the point of us doing this, Daniel's walked away as though he's Damien.
It's not an allergy to scripture.
You're like Damien in The Omen. As soon as the scripture is mentioned, you flee from the room. No, of course you don't, Daniel.
Just managing a Labrador.
Exactly. You cleave to the scripture like an infant at his mother's breast. Right. Here we go. Let's talk about this. Now, part of the reason we want to do this is because we want to show how relevant the Bible is in so many ways to what's going on. And this is something somebody actually suggested this scripture to me, but I think it's highly relevant. So the scripture is Luke chapter 12 and then verses 4, 5 and following. And this is Christ speaking. So Christ says here, "I tell you, my friends, do not fear those who kill the body and after that have no more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has power to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 pennies? And not one of them is forgotten before God. Why, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, you are of more value than many sparrows." And I thought that was really relevant when you consider, for example, that Christ in this passage says, don't fear people who can kill the body. In other words, you know, the body being killed is not the most significant thing in life. I'm not saying it's insignificant, but it's not the most significant. What the most significant thing is to fear the one who has the power to kill, but also has the power to cast into hell. And he's obviously speaking about God. And so I guess the way you could kind of summarize this is to say that we should fear God above all else, because God has power over our eternal destiny and not just our temporal destiny. And I think that this is relevant to what's going on at the moment with all the COVID stuff, because I think basically what's happened is a total reversal of the teaching of Christ. We've told people not to fear God and not to worry about eternal things, but to be absolutely and totally preoccupied with the death of the body as an absolute priority. And so it seems to me that this is, as I say, this is a reversal of the teaching of Christ. And actually the ironic thing about this is that this is ultimately going to perpetuate fear, because we can't control our destiny in terms of our bodily death, because we are all destined to die. So if we spend our whole lives being obsessed with bodily death, we will not eradicate fear, and we won't live a peaceful life, but we will actually perpetuate fear within ourselves. The only way that we can know true peace is to fear God, which doesn't mean to be sort of terrified of God, but it means to prioritize God. Mm-hmm. And if we prioritize God and eternal things, then we have assurance of eternal life, and we can know freedom from the fear of death and genuine peace. So
I think modern life sometimes makes finding those priorities quite hard at times, because we are overloaded, aren't we, as people, with information, with tasks. Life is very busy. And you know, if I was to put a sort of Jordan Peterson kind of spin on this, even if you were unsure about the existence of God, you could say that life at its best, at its most heroic, has to transcend just survival.
Yes.
Has to, we have to have the furthest horizons we can have as to the meaning and purpose of life. Even if we feel that's something that we're just carving out ourselves, will give us a good life, a meaningful life.
Yeah.
For us as Christians, that ultimate horizon is God and God's law himself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And not to do that is to slide. Again, if you're another type of genre on this might be something like C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, you know, the subtleties of sliding down into a life which becomes chaotic.
Yes.
Becomes meaningless, where we're adrift.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, about getting the right anchoring, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you bring in that category of chaos, I think that is a really helpful way of putting it. And obviously, Peterson's two most recent books are about chaos and order, aren't they? And I think, you know, it reminds me of that that sort of Augustinian idea that if we have our priorities right, and we have a kind of transcendent longing for God as our priority in life, that will order the rest of our lives, because our ultimate priority is something which is, you know, of infinite value and is transcendent of all temporal concerns and everything like that. So there's a kind of end point or a goal to our lives which gives our lives meaning and focus and things like that. And so the chaotic elements of your life may remain, but those chaotic elements can at least theoretically be channeled towards something infinite and transcendent. Whereas if you don't have that transcendent goal or telos, then you're just, all you are is sort of you're subject to the tyranny of your own passion and psychological inclination. And so you're just, I'll go for this thing now because I want it, and now this thing, and now this thing, and now this thing. And that's actually a very chaotic way of living, because you're never actually, it's like a journey with no destination.
So I'm reminded, actually, it's something that you wrote, Daniel, in your article for The North American, where you pointed out that for Cranmer, freedom was a freedom from our own desire, whereas in the modern world, freedom is seen as a freedom to pursue our desire. And there's something really profound about that. It's been occupying me for a few days. Because truly, you can never really fulfill a desire by acquiring what it has.
Yes.
You know, the aim of it. You can never be fulfilled if you just pursue that desire. You can never be full of food if all you desire is food, because you'll always desire some more food. You can never have enough money, because once you have a certain amount of money, all you want is more money. There's no fulfillment. And actually, desire kind of self-bounds itself. It's the opposite of that wonderful picture of the human expanding their horizons. Actually, it collapses your horizon. And I think desire for a sort of a life of without risk is one of the, to bring us back to COVID, is one of the issues that is driving the government and the sort of public response to this, because they desire to live a risk-free life. And actually, that is inherently self-limiting, because without that risk, you can't grow.
Yeah,
that's, and actually opening our horizons.
I think there's reading around, it would seem there's suspicion that in a sort of collective AI algorithmic hive mind, we have programmed that is one of the main constants in our social media systems. Mm. So they will reflect that back.
Yeah.
If someone posts that, that will get more viewership if it goes down that doctrine of give us, you know, a safe reading of the world. It will max that up.
Yeah.
Alongside, ironically, in a sort of schizophrenic sense, it will max up also the things that inflame us, that get us going.
Yeah.
So we have those kind of two things, those two poles crashing together. It's a recipe for mental health
disaster.
Really.
Yeah.
And COVID tide has ramped it up, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this whole thing is parasitic on this idea of freedom as freedom from constraint. I mean, I think that's a very pertinent observation that you made in Daniel, channeled through Tom, of course. But, you know, the modern world defines freedom as freedom from interference, essentially, whereas Christianity, at least classically, has defined freedom as the freedom to become what you were created to be. And, you know, a good example of this might be in any discipline. But if you think of music, for example, if you sit down at the piano and try and play and you haven't been trained and you haven't practiced, you're not free. I mean, you can play any note, but you're not free. You can't play music. You can't play a tune. So there's no sense in which you're free. The only way that you can become free to be a musician is through being trained and practicing. And it's through that discipline and that focus and that time that you spend doing it that you are then free. And could anyone say that, you know, a very great concert pianist, or indeed Tom, you're an excellent musician, when somebody who's really gifted and has become a great musician sits down at the piano and they play something, they are free. You know, that's what they are. They're now free to be a musician, whereas previously they're not free. And so for the Christian, the truly free human life is a life that is patterned after the life of Christ. And it's the disciple of Christ who is truly free. And in that sense, we're not scared, just to bring it back to what we're talking about, we're not scared of death, because for us, death is not the ultimate limitation. In many ways, death is the doorway into eternity.
It's a necessary step.
Yeah,
it's the beginning. I'm reminded of The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. I don't know if you remember that wonderful scene where he meets a man with a lizard on his shoulder, who's the lizard's a representative of that man's anxiety and sort of small-mindedness, I think. And the angel that he meets slays the lizard. And the lizard's reborn as a stallion for him to ride. Unless we die to this world, St. Paul says, we won't rise to the next. That we were sown perishable, we were raised imperishable. Those great words from 1 Corinthians, you know, that sort of... And of course, that's what's been missing, isn't it? You know, rather than the church relying on the ancient wisdom of its own texts, it's pursued the government's safetyism through this time, and it's stultifying, and it's limited the boundaries of what the church can now say about anything. It's
crazy. It's really crazy, actually, because we know, don't we? We know that people are lapping it up when we are talking about this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That they appreciate it, they respond to it intelligently on the whole, you know, and you know, if you were in sales, you'd say, this is the market, chaps.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Move in.
Yeah.
And yet somehow the corporation seems incredibly shy of that whole constituency of people who want to hear and listen to the great existential questions, what we've just said in the last 5-10 minutes, you know. I think a lot of people would want to lean in and hear and say, tell me more.
Yeah, yeah.
And for some reason, C of E PLC doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I completely agree, Daniel, and it really touches something I feel very passionately about, is that this is either true or it's not, right? So, I mean, I was meditating on the book of Revelation the other day, the vision of the risen Christ, you know, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead and now I am alive and I have the keys of death and Hades. But that's either true of Christ or it's not, okay? If it's not true, then we're just wasting. Christianity is a total waste of time, and the church is a total waste of time. And all of us, we three, and any committed Christians, we're just absolutely wasting our lives. And you know, there might be some perks like, you know, salary, free houses, or whatever, but we're essentially wasting our lives, and we're frauds. But if it's true, then this message is literally the most important thing that any human being could ever hear, and it is necessary for people to hear this in order that they might know Christ and have eternal life and joy forever. There is nothing more important than that. And if that is God's message, can we not have confidence that people actually want to hear it? You know, is that not far more important than any message about, you know, I don't know, egalitarianism in society or the importance of recycling or whatever it might be. I mean, this trumps them all. This is infinitely more important and it's infinitely more powerful if it's true. So why don't we just get out there and have some confidence and actually start preaching the gospel for a change, instead of banging on about, you know, this kind of, you know, this sort of leftist woke agenda in an attempt to win over the favor of people who couldn't care less about us anyway. I mean,
I think the demographics are that the constituency that some people in the church seem to be putting a lot of effort and energy into really couldn't care less anyway, and are never going to darken the doors of the church. Well, but they might nod and say thank you for, you know, for acknowledging X, Y, and Z as an issue, but that's about it. Whereas I think the people that we are conversing with genuinely want to move forward. And I don't mean that in a, I'm trying to sell you a tub of ice cream kind of Christianity that, yeah. Like I'm just not reducing it to product sales. I know I've talked about sales a minute ago, but genuinely want to have that conversation and grow in that conversation and respect that. And it doesn't cost anything. What is it? It doesn't really cost us anything to do that. We don't need special committees.
No.
Or we don't need, I mean, yes, we're doing this with gadgets and technology, but you know.
Yeah, but Daniel, how much
is it? Do this at the pub, really. Yeah.
I mean, our overhead's almost nothing. I mean, we've all had to buy our computers, but our overhead to actually just produce the show, you know, obviously we want to sort of expand it and do other things, but the cost of actually running a podcast is basically nothing. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot of investment to get the word out there. And, you know, we're happy to say now that thousands of people are listening to this, and it's wonderful. And, you know, we're so happy about that, but everyone could be doing this. You know, everyone could be out there preaching the gospel, and thank goodness there are lots of people who are. I mean, one of the things I was going to say is I don't want to imply that, you know, this door isn't open for everyone. The only thing I was saying is that we tend to be trying to sort of reach people who tend to not be interested in the church and in Christianity. And, you know, I think we should preach the gospel to absolutely everyone. But at the same time, we have to recognize, you know, there are scriptural principles, aren't there, of trying to recognize who is open to the gospel and who is not. And, you know, moving, as it were, from town to town, preaching the gospel and shaking the dust off your feet if people are not interested. So I don't want to be misunderstood in terms of what I was saying. All I was saying is I think it's quite a strange thing to spend all your time trying to reach a group of people who have shown no, you know, they've shown no sign that they're interested in the church or anything the church has got to say. That's all I meant. But we should probably talk about some current affairs now, I think. Tom, by the way, when you're mentioning The Great Divorce, you actually have my copy of The Great Divorce, which, it's my copy, and I want it back. Now, I'm only joking. I don't. You can keep it. I've got a stamp now, which when I lend people books,
It means I can't pitch more of your diary.
I put my mark on it.
It's a tracker, really.
It's a tracker. It's a tracker in the vaccine.
I thought I'd given that back, Jim. I'm just looking for it.
No, you haven't given it back.
There's a fine, Tom.
You've also got my copy of
Pound a Day.
You've got my copy of Crime and Punishment as well, Tom, which...
That I have got somewhere, yeah. It's very good.
Have you read it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, at least you've read it. At least that takes the edge off the insult a little bit.
I've read The Great Divorce as well. Actually, I've got an anthology of C.S. Lewis these days, which has just... I mean, it's lacking some of his later works, but I wish it had on The Abolition of Man, actually, but that's the big one it's missing. But it's got just about everything else by him.
Yeah, I know, but Tom, if you're looking for intellectual kudos, it's much more impressive to say that you've read Dostoevsky than C.S. Lewis, as great as C.S. Lewis is.
Dostoevsky was all right. I mean, yeah.
No, Tom, seriously, we're not going to get into this. This is going to make me angry. Right. nobody is flagging off Dostoevsky on this podcast. Anyway, we don't want to get into that. It's too esoteric. It's too elitist, and we're not having any of that. We're here for the common man. That's who we're here for. Right.
We're here for Boris's wallpaper.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Now, what should we do first? Like, should we talk about, we can talk about church stuff, or we can talk about political stuff. What's your view?
Let's just start with political stuff, because we talk quite a lot about churchy stuff, and we've got some non-churchy people out there, so we should talk about...
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm willing to kick off here. I was very interested this week to read... about the story about Johnny Mercer, and I don't know whether either of you have come across this. Johnny Mercer was an MP, but he's resigned now. Mm-hmm. And I'll read some of this. is from the Fount of All Truth, The Guardian, and it says the following: the former Veterans Minister Johnny Mercer has launched an extraordinary attack on Boris Johnson's government, describing it as a cesspit and the most distrustful, awful environment I've ever worked in. A day after his resignation, the MP also accused ministers of being cowards for not implementing a controversial pledge to end vexatious historical investigations of veterans who served in Northern Ireland. Mercer quit for that reason. And then in an interview, which was on Times Radio, a clearly angry Mercer said his resignation was an act of personal accountability. And then the same quote again: this is the most distrustful, awful environment I've ever worked in government. Almost nobody tells the truth, is what I've worked out for the last 36 hours. And, you know, I don't think anyone really can get on their high horse about trust and ethics and all the rest of it in politics, because as far as I'm concerned, most of it is a cesspit. And he was going to resign quietly, but because of the way things were carried through, he decided to make it more public and make a stand. So I thought that was, I mean, obviously, chaps, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I think, you know, as I've said before, I think these people are lying to the public in many ways, and really what they're interested in is controlling our behavior rather than telling us the truth. But I think it's quite an interesting insight into what's going on there, that an MP would come out and say so strongly that, I mean, what did he say? Basically, everyone lies all the time. And that it's...
No, I mean, he's a star MP. You know, he's nearby here. You know, his constituency is a couple of doors down from here. Very popular, often on local TV, this yep. and that. Really connected with folks. So, you know, for Boris Johnson, the government, to lose one of its rising stars like this, you know, somebody whose USP is integrity and character, well, it's not looking good, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think
unlike Downing Street flat, which apparently is looking superb at the moment,
isn't it? I mean, this comes on top of the same week as this new and unsightly spats between Cummings and Boris about exactly what happened before the November lockdown. And you get the impression that this administration is already acting as if it had been in power. It's like the end of the major period, isn't it? Sort of tired, old administration, or the end of Gordon Brown's administration. No one really taking accountability. We're stuck in a continuing lockdown with no particularly good reason. Boris hasn't really got the authority to push against his ministers who clearly want it. His ministers don't have the integrity just to say what they think. You've got various ministers doing their own projects. You've got, with vaccine passports and Gove sort of stuff like that, despite the fact that I suspect you know, they're unusable, unworkable, and no one really wants them. And no one's got the balls to just sort of say, no, this is no good. It's a bit like, you know, I think someone in The Spectator said about the testing, the mass testing. Didn't someone say, you know, there's no point in this moonshot. There never has been because they're not reliable enough to test like that. But now we've got the vaccines out there. There's no point in mass testing. It's just mass testing.
I'm doing that at the moment.
sorry, Tom.
There's no point in it at this point. There's no point in it at this point. And it was always a sort of statistical nightmare because of the sheer number of tests. They're without any idea of where they should be, where they want to be going. You know, they need to go, you know, just need to go. They all need to resign.
Yeah. I mean, something that I find remarkable about what's happened over the last 18 months is the way that MPs have basically gone, and particularly, I suppose, the government, they've basically gone from being, in the eyes of the public, sleaze bags and liars to being sort of, you know, completely and utterly white knights, you know, trustworthy white knights in shining armor. And I think it's a lot to do with the propaganda, you know, spreading fear that people feel that they must trust them. But if you consider, for example, the MP expenses scandal, you know, the sleaze and corruption that was exposed as a result of that. And Boris, you know, I mean, I don't want to go through a litany of his past misdemeanors as a person, but you can Google pretty easily and find out what kind of person he is. You know, what reason is there to believe that these people are truthful or trustworthy or moral? And the answer is, there's no reason. And when there is somebody who actually has some integrity, somebody like Johnny Mercer, he finds it so repulsive that he needs to quit. He needs to quit. So, I mean, it's just, you know, it's further confirmation, isn't it, of the corruption and the sleaze. And Daniel, you're obviously referring to this story. You'll have to tell me the details, appraise me of the details. But basically, Boris has acquired money in an unhanded way in order to refurbish number 10 at the behest of his, I don't know, they're not married, so what is she? His partner, is that right?
Yeah. Yes, and looking at it this morning, the media was reminding us that I think he's allowed a grant. He's allowed to do about £30,000 worth of work that he claims from the government, but there's an estimation now that it might be revealed that about £200,000 worth of work has been done upstairs.
To refurbish an upstairs flat.
Well, it's a big flat, but it's a big flat because it goes into the back, doesn't it? And there's a big sort of Georgian house out the back of 10 Downing Street, as I understand. But even so, it's presumably not exactly that bad because it's maintained sort of yearly, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, so that's over 2 years' salary for Stephen Cottrell's personal assistant. I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of money, isn't it?
But I mean, it's nothing compared to the ongoing cost of lockdown each day, so we shouldn't complain too much, really.
Maybe that's what Boris thinks. Oh, well, you know.
The irony is the Beeb did a programme, Panorama programme, I think it was a couple of years ago, on the state of the Westminster Palace.
Yeah.
Which, you know, well, I've been in ministry about 25 years, and you get a feel for buildings and the sort of things that need to be done. And even myself, as someone who doesn't come from a building or architectural background, you know, you do have an eye for places and historic places. And their documentary was quite shocking, actually, the state of the Westminster buildings.
Yeah,
it's really run down, surprisingly run down. It's not prioritised. I know that there's been this whole conversation about the moving the Parliament, and you know they've got billions of catch up to do. Yeah. So, you know, this is a group of people. Maybe it's because they're transient, and maybe it's just because they're not kind of morally focused enough on the treasures that are put in their lap.
Yeah,
but They clearly have some very strange relationships with buildings, whether it's 10 Downing Street, the House of Parliament. You know, they're either odiously lavished, or completely run down.
Yeah.
And irony is he only has to walk 500 yards down the road to see a building that has got some serious, serious issues.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Designed, of course, by the great Augustus Pugin, which is a beautiful building, isn't it? It needs to have some money spent on it. So let's hope that Boris will channel some of his funding into that very soon. I thought that was a very interesting story, Traps. And, you know, I've made it very clear what I think about these politicians. And the Mercer thing, and it, you know, all of this scandal and this sleaze that comes out, it doesn't surprise me at all. But chap, should we go on to talk about? I mean, are there any other big political things? Because there are some things in the church that I think would be really good to mention. So, I mean, is there any other stuff that's happened this week politically, or should we go into some of this church stuff?
Been a quiet one, haven't we? We haven't had our briefing of doom by Boris.
I never watch those anyway, Tom. Let's talk about some church stuff, because I'm sure people would be interested in this. So we're going to talk about bell ringing in a minute, but this is really good. Daniel's just pointed me to this. So this is Premier Christian, the robot. Right, listen to this. Right, a quarter of Brits. Presumably that's all Britons, say they would take spiritual advice from a robot priest. And we're not talking metaphorically, we're talking actual robots. So one in four people in Britain would take spiritual advice from a robot priest. And there is a debate, which I believe is being hosted by Justin Brierley, and they're going to examine some of the big questions around technology, artificial intelligence, and the church. In the debate, one of them claims controversially that it is impossible in principle to have a digital computational system that would be fully conscious and indistinguishable from the kind of consciousness experienced by humans. Furthermore, he shares what he describes as the simulation hypothesis, where we are living in a computer simulation in a literal sense, built by some advanced civilization, a bit like the Matrix that we were talking about last week. The other one in this debate, who leads research, developing AI, etc., reveals she likes the idea of a superintelligence out there able to change things in our world, but argues the weight of evidence, since in favor of the God of the Bible as being that source, as opposed to something out there. Brierley comments, "This is a truly fascinating debate with two brilliant guests who address the topic from a Christian and non-Christian perspective. Interestingly, in a recent survey conducted by Savanta Comres for Premier Christian Radio, one in five of those polled said they believe we are living in an artificial intelligence simulation." Wow, as many as that. A quarter of those surveyed said they would be willing to take spiritual advice from an AI robot replica of a priest instead of a human priest. So whilst this may have seemed like something from a sci-fi movie just a few years ago, many are now beginning to give the whole subject serious consideration. And then there are some more comments here, and then a quote here. One of them comments, "I hope we don't lose the human touch of the local priest, vicar, or church minister. A robot in a dog collar may be able to say a prayer for you or administer the last rites, but does an AI algorithm really care about your soul?" Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Maybe we should lobby for a digital robotic supremo.
Yes.
Have we got one already?
A digital church needs a digital vicar. Yeah.
I think whoever wrote this has got a screw loose, really. I mean, to be honest, who takes these polls seriously anyway? There's, you know, people, I don't think people seriously want a digital vicar or a robotic vicar. They've already got digital vicars in most of the land. Robotic vicar, I should say.
Robot vicar, not robotic.
A proper adjective, isn't it? Anyway,
you say 20% of Brits say they would have a robot vicar, but 40%
already have.
They don't know they have one. Yeah. They don't know they got one already. The answer, of course, is you can't say a prayer without the intention of a prayer. So it doesn't really matter. A robot could never just have a robot speaking a prayer. It would be a complete waste of time. You may as well have a CT, you know, a CD of the last rites you put next to someone. It would have exactly the same sort of authority and in effect. It would just be creepy.
I mean, I think sacramentally, I mean, obviously, with a sacrament, you need the appropriate material in the sacrament, don't you? So you have to have an ordained priest to, I mean, obviously, you know, slight sort of a theological issues, but to do a sacrament like the Eucharist, you have to have at the very least, you need a human being.
We could move outside of a Church of England sort of framework and say you have an authorized leader of some sort.
Yeah, but that leader needs to be a human being, don't they, Tom?
Obviously.
Every Christian agrees that you can't like be baptized, for example, by a robot. I mean, that's just nuts, really.
That's a canon law question.
But I guess
are robot baptisms valid?
I mean, let's get Synod working on it. We might have a report in 6 years.
Working party needed.
A 550-page report, half of which argues that that you can, the other half of which argues that you can't. Yeah. The conclusion.
Yeah, and then we can have some study days. But the point I think I want to make about this is that if you say, I mean, obviously, I don't believe that machines can be conscious. I just don't believe that. Whatever it is, it will just be a highly complex algorithm, right? So even if it is an algorithm that can develop itself, it's still not conscious like a human being is conscious. But so basically what you'd be doing with this robot priest is you'd be going to it and saying, well, you know, I've got this problem, you know, I'm thinking about getting married, but I'm not sure. And essentially what you'd be doing is a more sophisticated version of, you know, a kind of what are those balls, you know, those balls which you kind of shake up and then
magic eight balls.
Magic eight ball. It would just be like a sophisticated version of that, right? So you would have your input, which would be what you say, then the algorithm would get to work on it, and then it would say something back to you. But that's not the same. Right. That's not even close to being the same. It's a different category of communication to a communication with an actual human being, particularly a human being who is a Christian or a priest who can be guided in that unique way that human beings can be by the Holy Spirit, right?
I've just got this vision in somewhere like a hospital chaplaincy, that these robots going down corridors with cassocks, you know, sort of handing out sacraments or Bibles.
As a fan of Futurama, I've got an image of the robo priest from Futurama. There actually is one there who administers the rites of the robot religion.
Yes, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of look like a jukebox with stained glass on it.
I have to make a confession here that one of the best hours of my life was we have a parishioner. We have a parishioner who moaned at me for not turning up at the church fete, allegedly, a few years ago. But I was there, but I wasn't. What it is that I have a colleague in Plymouth who created a life-size Dalek, which was in a mobility scooter, and he rents it out to charities. He's a military chaplain, absolute great guy. Carl Freeman, and it even pushes out smoke. It's got the voice changer, and it's been on the local telly and what have you. So I borrowed this and was in this for about an hour or two, going around the school playground where we're having the church fete, exterminating people, and no one knew it was me because my voice was changed. But after a while, the great thing is as you're hanging around in this, you begin to hear people, you know, having a moan and a bitch about things, and, you know, men going on about their wives, and, you know, and this one dear sweet, sweet old lady suddenly turned acidic and said, you know, you'd think the vicar would turn up to his own fate. I thought that was the most serendipitous moment in my life.
Did you jump out?
She was just on the edge. She was just on the edge of this bank, and I thought, if I extend the sucker, this could be quite fatal. But I did tell her a few weeks later from the pulpit, and
from the pulpit.
I said, I've got to tell you this, but but anyway, apparently, a friend of a friend's who worked in Tesco's, and this was actually backed up by a Radio 4 program again some years back, I heard that supermarkets are thinking of, you know, changing the start of actually getting androids
in the checkouts.
Apparently that these the same type of super marionation is used in the adult industry of robotics, and this Radio 4 program saying that the supermarkets are really quite keen on this, you know, that you could save an enormous amount of money by having, you know, a robot that maybe costs, you know, 10-20 grand to build, that has a sort of Siri-like interface and can tell the difference between spuds and carrots.
Daniel, what you're saying is that Sainsbury's are going to get... they're going to employ sex robots. Is that what you were saying? I mean, it sounds. So. let's hope they. Let's
every
hope
little they, helps.
That's Tesco's, isn't it?
What's Sainsbury's?
I don't know.
Who knows? We're gonna end up going back into our discussion from earlier, aren't we, about diocesan and taglines?
Well, Sainsbury's are in trouble in Cornwall at the moment because they advertised they had a huge billboard apparently with they got the scone the wrong way around.
Right.
Okay. So what is the way around for the Cornwall?
It's jam first, cream after. Whereas in Devon, you see.
It's cream first and jam after, which is the proper way around.
Our generous orthodoxy is the other way around, really.
Yeah. Now, I'm not going to say which one of you said this, but one of you came up for it with, or let's not say one of you, actually. Let's say somebody came up with a tagline for the Church of England, which, you know, because we've got various kind of strap lines. And
every diocese has to have one. Yeah,
exactly. It was actually drawn from the Lord of the Rings.
Well, they're not going to know it's going to be me, then, aren't they? I mean, because I'm the only one who quotes the Lord of the Rings around here. But I've already done it twice this podcast. I think it's honestly. I think some dioceses take their tagline from Galadriel at the end of the Fellowship of the Ring.
Wait, Tom, don't give an anonymous vicar. somewhere in the south of England,
dressed in blue,
suggested that it's going to be an anticlimax now, but I will decline and go into the west. I think that is that's our official suggestion
for the Church of England.
For a new tagline for the Church of England.
So we're all going to get on the boats and just sail off to.
If anyone can top that, or indeed if anyone can guess who wrote it, then
there should be a prize.
Yeah, there should be a prize for that. But that is, I will decline and go into the West. That is brilliant. So well done, whoever came up with that.
We were talking about taglines though, because every diocese has one, and you sort of have to repeat them. Yes. You know, like a. I particularly like Jamie's diocese, actually. I'm a big fan of it because it's strong. You have to say it with a clenched fist, you know, if it's sort of wider, deeper, younger.
Yes.
You know, it's strong stuff going on there. Whereas here we're hope, pray, serve. And apparently Devon have nicked it.
We're pray, grow, serve. I almost forgot it there. Gosh,
Pray, grow, serve,
yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I think we're pray, serve, grow. I don't know. Anyway,
pray, serve, grow makes more sense to me. But I wonder where is preach in that? I mean, is that part of serving? Maybe I don't really know. But it seems to me that preaching should be there somewhere as well. I mean, just to
you could have preach, explain. Teach.
Yeah, preach. Preach, teach, preach, pray, teach, grow, learn. I don't know. I'm just making up words now. But anyway, my one is growing disciples wider, deeper, and younger. And I think it's important to make it clear that when it says wider, it doesn't mean like the individual disciples.
I'm gonna have to stop.
It doesn't mean like making disciples fatter. It means reaching more people. So it is likewise with the deeper thing as well, like burying disciples in the ground.
Do any of you guys subscribe to the? Take a deep breath here. The Facebook Church Typos.
No, I've heard brilliant. Of it though.
It's a real fest of the worst typos that have gone in like service sheets.
Chris will save you and that sort of thing.
Cathedrals are particularly noted for doing this. You know, expensive booklets that have got the most delicious typo on it. The most popular one is often, "Do you believe in Chris?"
Yeah. I mean, that's easily done, isn't it? That's easy. Yeah. I've written, you know, when I've been writing stuff, I frequently write Christ instead of Chris. So, you know, when I've been denouncing Chris Whitty, that's been, you know, I've been close to blasphemy.
Christ Whitty.
Whitty the Christ. I mean, that kind of thing is very easily done. Have you any more on the tip of your tongue, Daniel? Because this is kind of...
Holy angles is quite common, isn't it? Holy angles. Yeah.
We did one which we sent up, which was "Peach be with you." Which got some amusement. And there was a church, I think it's in your neck of the woods, Jamie, that had a huge mural with the words "Arise." Yeah. And they obviously spent a fortune on this beautiful mosaic and then put a tree in the middle of it. And as the tree grew from the dual carriageway, people got a different face message, let's say.
It looked like a different word. That is very unfortunate. These things need to be planned out before they are implemented. Chaps, I'm interested to hear the story that you two have been across about bell ringing in the church.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? So I started... So let's go with some context. So the bell ringing church is obviously a particularly English art, to those of you who are international sort of listeners. The each diocese has an organisation sort of attached to that sort of looks after its bell ringers who provide a service in this particular type of ringing that we do. And there's a central council called the Church Council, the Central Council of Church Bell Ringers. And
which is like the Council of Elrond.
It's a bit like no, not at all, because unlike the Council of Elrond, there's not really any need for them. And the problem is with these sort of
in the Council of Elrond, Tom.
They like to think of themselves as sort of the FA of the football, sort of, you know,
of the bell ringing world. You mean
of the bell ringing world? But the problem is that not many bell ringers actually care what goes on, so it tends to be a very sort of cliquey thing where there's a local associations elect representatives to go to the CCCBR, who then elect an executive committee whose job it is to support ringing. Unfortunately they haven't. In fact, quite the opposite. I mean, they're, as far as I can tell, they're the only organisation attached to a hobby which has successfully negotiated with the government for harsher restrictions on that particular hobby than the law actually required. So when everyone was under the we're working, remember back in June when we went to the 1 meter plus kind of system, and the Church Council of Bellringers managed to successfully negotiate 1.5 meters plus for no apparent reason, which is a real faff, because quite often the church, 1 meters, you can get in a normal sized church bell ringing tower, you might have a meter between the ropes, but you might not have 1.5 meters. You really restrict what can be done. Anyway, they've recently.
I suppose if you climbed up the rope, you could be at different sort of heights. That might be.
Unfortunately, you can't hover and ring. Or at least I've never experienced it working very well.
Only the charismatics can do that.
Or the other Catholics, you know, very some very holy people have claimed to hover, the St. Teresa of Avila.
Was Francis of Assisi meant to have done some levity? Oh, no, Thomas Aquinas. Anyway, sorry, carry on, Tom. What happened now?
So they've released their guideline, their roadmap out of ringing. And,
out of ringing?
out of lockdown. And what they've done is they've produced a page which basically follows the government guidance. And, you know, anyone... there's a question there, because I think it's an act of worship and actually comes under slightly different guidance than sort of general activities. But, you know, okay, they've got a page though attached to that, which is "Should you ring?" is the name of the page. Should you ring? And it heavily implies that people who are in risky professions, like nursing or sort of customer facing ones, and people who haven't been vaccinated shouldn't ring or should think twice about ringing. It exhorts those who are going to share their medical status with the rest of the ringers in order to make them feel happy about ringing with them.
Does it specify how you should do that? I mean, should you all sort of sit down and take turns to read out your medical?
Yeah, my name's Tom and I haven't been vaccinated. There's so many problems with this, not least because it's, you know, we're talking about as a bell ringer, I fervently believe is an act of worship. Now, bell ringers are a funny lot. Not every vicar would agree with me, but actually, I, as a ringer, I consider it to be an act of worship. You're making joyful noise upon the cymbals for God to summon people to worship, to celebrate things. That to be expected to share your medical status in order to participate in an act of worship is completely outrageous. I believe Daniel wrote something to them along those lines, didn't you?
There was a little contact form. So on my smartphone, I was able to pin a few lines and I got a reply the next day. Mindful of the guidelines being for the period between 17th of May to 21st June. I was corrected that the Church of England, the House of Bishops, it seemed, Bishops Recovery Group, sorry, had a discussion with them. Though I don't think on the first page, the page where you saw those guidelines, that's clear. You have to go a bit deeper.
Daniel, just for our listeners, what are the bishops actually recovering from? Are they recovering? I've actually forgotten myself. What's the bishops' recovery group? They're not.
Oh yes, this is the sort of COVID response group,
right,
of the Church of England.
Yeah,
it's not a.
It's not like Alcoholics Anonymous for bishops.
No, it's not like that. It's not like. This is getting very frivolous, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, what have they said?
I used to be a bishop, but now I'm no more.
Recovering from. You know, I've met lots of people who describe themselves as recovering evangelicals. Maybe there could be a recovering. I'm recovering from being a bishop as well. Anyway, sorry, the Episcopal Recovery Group.
Dear souls, it's a hard job, so blame them if they were, you know?
I mean, they need our sympathy. They need our prayers. Right.
I'm trying to keep my job here.
No, what have they said? What have these bishops said? Have they sorted out those bell ringers? Have they gone in and bashed the bell ringers? Come on, let's have some drama.
Anyway, the reply said, with respect to encouraging people to be open and honest with one another about their medical status, I think an appropriate attitude is summed up in the previous sentence, in caring for one another. The guidelines is exhorting ringers to put the interests of others before their own. This could take the form of voluntary informing their band of something medical, or of absenting themselves from whatever is a voluntary activity if they prefer not to do so. What would not be justifiable would be putting others at risk without informing them.
Oh dear. Ooh.
So that's coercion there, isn't it? I mean, you can't say, on the one hand, we need to be, voluntary, kind of let's all be in this together to protect each other. And then on the other hand, say, but if you don't, then, that's bad. you know, you can't have both positions held at the same time. They're literally contradictory. Let's be honest. Let's be clear, I should say. You know, it's not okay to expect people to share medical information as a part of engaging in church activities.
And it's interesting, is it? Because it's on the back door. Because we were involved, and Jamie particularly, in this petition about vaccine passports not happening on our grounds. Now here we've got an organization which has involvement within our churches, saying that they're going to have a policy potentially independent of the parish priest. That doesn't sit, whatever that policy might be, that doesn't sit easy with me, because that firstly should be a dialogue with the PCC and the vicar, the church council and the vicar. So we could end up with churches where there is what we were really saying passionately we didn't want to happen happening through the back door.
It's a de facto vaccine passport, isn't it, to ask people to absent themselves voluntarily if they haven't had the vaccine. But I mean, can I just interject here, and I know I've made this point before in this podcast, but this whole conversation about putting people at risk is total nonsense when it comes to this thing about the vaccine. If the vaccine protects people, then the status of other people in terms of whether they've been vaccinated or not is irrelevant.
Of course it is. But this is
nonsense. Saying if you're not vaccinated, you're a risk. That's not true. And it's creating a group of people who are going to be othered in our society and rejected and vilified and avoided. And it's profoundly, firstly, it's illogical, but it's profoundly anti-Christian as well.
But I think it's...
unvaccinated people in this way. Sorry, Tom, carry on.
No, I think you're right. But I mean, they sort of qualify this a bit in the page by saying, oh, you know, vaccines might not be effective. But the problem is that we're now at a point where, or at least they say, even if they are effective, they're not entirely effective. But we have to come back really to the point where, you know, no risk appears to be acceptable to them. And actually there's a risk, there's all sorts of risks in church bell ringing. I mean, they're not very high risks. Generally people don't get hurt, but people do sometimes, people get, there can be mechanical failures. People can, most injuries, things like sprained wrists or, trip up a couple of steps and hurt your knee, that sort of thing. Quite common, happened to me, there are risks inherent in this activity. If they're going to take this sort of hardline no risk from COVID, then they should do that with everything and effectively shut themselves down and shut all ringing down, because it's just not worth the risk. But actually, we've always rung quite happily prior to COVID. And they rang, I've no doubt, through the 1918 flu, and they rang through the 1956 and the 1968 ones. You know, actually, what they're responsibility as an organization isn't to decide what risk people should and shouldn't take. It's not their business. It's none of their business at all. That actually is between the ringers and the vicar within the appropriate government guidelines.
It's going to be difficult, isn't it? Because let's take another instance. Durham University introduces COVID status certifications. This is a story that's come out from Lockdown Skeptics. Now, who's to say that Durham University and any other organisation do not use churches as outflows for campuses? That's where I'm going with this. You could have all sorts of organisations that use your church and behind your back start asking for status certificates of that ilk, or imply that our study group won't meet unless you can produce COVID negative test twice a week. That could happen in our premises. That worries me.
Sorry, Tom, just to interject quickly. I mean, the way we used to think about this was that if you don't want to take a risk, you stay at home. It wasn't that literally everyone in society stays at home in order to protect people who are you know, who have received an appropriate medical treatment to protect themselves. It was that if you feel yourself at risk, you know, say you have another vaccine or something, or you're concerned that the vaccine isn't going to work, you can stay, you're free to stay at home. But if you enter the world, if you leave your house and enter the world, you are taking a risk with your own health. It doesn't matter how many times you've been vaccinated. You could be run over by a car. You know, when you step out the front door, you're taking a risk, and that will always be true, regardless of your medical status. Sorry, Tom.
No, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? And so in the end, what the role of the CCCBR, the Central Council of Church Bellring, should be, and indeed all interest groups, is not being preachy this sort of thing. It is simply to interpret the rules in such a way as to make their members understand them. So they should say, as of the 17th of May, you're able to ring as of six, you know, rule of six indoors. And that's the end of it. You know, it's likely that you'll be asked to social distance if possible and wear masks, you know. Quite why there's so much more danger in a church. It's always irritated me because you can sit around a pub table and no one's pretending that you're sitting opposite someone, even outside, you know, or indeed inside, and there's any social distancing going on between them. But, you know, they'll mandate social distancing in a ringing the church bells for some weird reason. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. You know, the on the one hand, you know, you've got six people sat around a table indoors. On the other hand, you're not allowed to ring six bells or whatever. It makes no sense. But, you know, they should, the most they should be doing is helping towers interpret and, you know, informing people as to how this can play out just by the letter of the law. They shouldn't be going around adding anything to that because it's none of their business.
Yes.
It's the business, but it's entirely between the church ringers themselves in the tower. It's entirely between them, and it's entirely between them and the vicar in terms of what the church's health and safety policy allows. And they just need to, they've overinflated their own importance, especially negotiating stronger restrictions than legally required. It's you know, we don't need that. It's not necessary.
I think that bell ringers, they are of a certain type, though, aren't they, Tom? Let's face facts. I used to work in the cathedral. I know what it was like when I walked in there. When I walked in the bell tower and all the bell ringers were there, and they weren't expecting me to be there, they'd give me those looks. You know, this is a local tower for local bell ringers. Who are you,
Jamie?
And I would say that I actually work in this cathedral. I have all the keys. I open this door for you. You know, you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for me. This whole building wouldn't even be open. You know,
I can see why they didn't like you. You know,
all right, chaps. I think we've absolutely bashed those bells, and I think we should move on to what will probably be our final topic of the day before we talk about the old emails of the week. And so what we're going to talk about now is, of course, the Church of England's From Lament to Action document, which Daniel, you've been sort of a bit busy writing a few bits and pieces about this, the Anti-Racism Task Force report. And this has been, I think it's fair to say, quite controversial. This is a report that's been written by the Anti-Racism Task Force in the Church of England, which, if you don't know, is a kind of response to the claims that the Church of England is deeply institutionally racist. So the church, obviously, at this sort of Episcopal level, is saying this, that the church is institutionally racist, and we've got a lot of work to do in order to be less racist, and we've got to do all these things now, such as having quotas for ordained ministry. For any post, there needs to be quotas now. There needs to be much more talk of black theology in colleges, and loads of other stuff as well. Calvin Robinson has written a good letter trying to provide an alternative point of view about this, which I'm happy to put on the show notes, and exposing quite a lot of this, the faulty thinking in this report. Daniel, I know you've said a lot about this as well. I don't know if you want to sort of jump in and comment.
Sure, yeah. Calvin and I have done a number of bits and pieces. He's written a piece for the Telegraph as well over the weekend on this. In fact, on my own blog, notes to the underground church.blogspot.com, Christoph de Ray, one of my theological future interns, has just written a piece, Should the Church Condemn Institutional Racism? So
yeah,
do go and have a look at that.
I'll put it on the show notes.
He begins with actually Archbishop Welby's statement that was made in General Synod February last year. Quote, there is no doubt when we look at our own church, that we are still deeply institutionally racist. Let's be clear about that. Mm-hmm. The report came out a couple of days after the Panorama program as well, which highlighted some stories of racism.
Yeah.
And what have you. I think what I found particularly interesting was that Douglas Murray had received a leaked draft about 6 weeks ago, which he did quite a tough Spectator piece on.
Yeah.
Highlighting all the word, you know, all the words were there that you'd expect in a kind of, you know, hard left woke sort of analysis of things, you know, white privilege, white normativity, etc., etc.
Eurocentrism.
Eurocentrism, Christendom was poo-pooed.
No, we can't have Christendom. That is very bad.
Christendom, that's very bad. You know,
we must have late modern Western secularism.
Inspired by that wonderful North African, you know, Augustine. You know.
Yes. Silly.
The thing is,
with his silly theology,
they don't really mean when they say. When they say black theology, sort of TM, they don't actually mean theology by black theologians, because I mean that is, and I you know, there are plenty of excellent African and black, you know, and probably, I mean, Augustine was a Roman citizen, so he probably wasn't black skinned, but
he was half Berber, Tom, so he would have looked like Zinedine Zidane or someone like that.
Yeah, so yeah, dark, he was dark, dark black skin,
sort of. Not black, but dark skin for sure.
They're not talking about, you know, theology from those people, because that's already widely celebrated in the Church of England, or at least within the curriculums. I think I spoke a few weeks ago about how I did quite a lot of work on Ubuntu, which is classically kind of a black sort of cultural movement, should we say?
Not to be confused with Mbongo.
Which no
fruit juice.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think that's that's a really bad joke. I think the what they mean by black theology is, of course, the sort of racial it's a theology that's come out of Marxism and a type of thinking which sort of looks at it looks at everyone as a kind of as a separate identities and the sort of the tension between them, which is not necessarily helpful. In fact, it's the opposite of, you know, the vision in the Bible for different people, exactly, different races coming together. It's not actually very Christian.
The critical race theory, or the critical theory, which comes out of itself, I think I'm right, out of the Frankfurt School, it is an attempt at bringing in that sort of hard left vision of society into the West. What was particular was that the first draft is full of it, including suggestions that the Church of England should liaise and combine up with the Black Lives Matter movement, with the Sadiq Khan Statues Commission, with the something or other group in Bristol that were instrumental in organising
illegal riot and the...
And so on.
The destruction of private property,
yeah. I mean, I think Calvin did a much more analytical job than I've done in writings on this. And in all sorts of presumptions, including presumptions about racism and COVID and that I don't particularly want to go into here, but it was clear that the second document, this stuff was airbrushed out.
Yeah.
Now, it may have been that someone got the jitters, or the Douglas Murray article upset them. They saw that this is not going to go down well in a good section of society. So, you know, tone it down.
Yeah.
Take all this take some of this stuff out. Yet it's, you can't help when you read the, I don't read all the 71 pages. I mean, because 40 or so of it is footnotes, which seemed a bit over the top. But it's still there, you know. And you think, what is the mood of the Church of England on this? Well, a few weeks before, the College of Bishops in London wrote quite a condemnatory piece about the government's independent commission on racism, because they felt that it presented too much of an optimistic picture.
Yeah.
God forbid the bishops being optimistic.
Yeah, and they quoted the end of their letter, the Bishop of Dover, Rose Hudson Wilkinson, yeah, that Britain is not as yet a model country, you know, on this issue. Now, I think that's incredibly questionable. But even if that analysis is right, do we want, in combating racism, in our toolbox as the Church of England, do we want unbiased conscious training? Do we want critical race theory? You know, do we want that whole package, which has been tried and tested, you know, that the lived experience of it in universities, let's be fair, true, isn't it? Is basically a cancel culture where everybody is afraid to say anything.
Yes.
Do we want to turn the Church of England into that sort of culture? I think that would be horrific to do that. You know, one of the things that, you know, I think that the CV still has an element of, you know, you can have a good debate without fear of being sacked. And do we want that to be the new big tent? Do we want our churches to feel, our church culture to feel like the universities? Yeah. I really hope not. I mean, the irony is, that's my last point, the irony is, in terms of black theology, as Tom has rightly picked up, you know, is that a large part of the Anglican Communion is a traditional conservative Anglicanism in the global South.
Yeah.
And the last thing they're going to want is CRT.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was quite interesting seeing a response to this in by Marcus Walker, where I think he quite rightly points out that his experience of time in Rome, he was in the Anglican Youth Forum in Rome, and they had, you know, Anglican children, young Anglican theologians from across the world coming and staying with them in Rome. And his experience wasn't that they wanted to talk about race and injustice, but they wanted to talk about God and the Bible, you know, and that, you know, that is, if anything, like an authentic black theology is Bible believing. It is very orthodox. It is passionate and full of the Spirit. It is all the things the Church of England is not. So, yeah, I welcome that into the Church of England. Absolutely.
I think you guys said it last week, you know, bring it on.
Yeah. Bring it on.
And you know, it wasn't this one of the errors that I think is not acknowledged in this report. That in the Windrush generation came over, they came into our churches and they found them lacking in faith, really.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they thought, well, let's go and found our own churches, for goodness sake. And what you ended up with is Pentecostal independent churches springing up all over the place because we weren't fired up enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pattern that's repeated across history, isn't it?
That we should take note of.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, CRT I think CRT is a type of colonialism, really. And when you actually think about this on the local level, most congregations, you know, outside of places like Oxford, Cambridge and central London or metropolitan areas of London, are completely unaware. My congregation don't even know that this exists. So if you go into their church, if you go into our church and say, right, everyone now, we've got to talk about the way that the human race is basically divided into people who have been oppressive and people who have been oppressed, and we need to have, you know, reparations and quotas, and we need to have, you know, sort of mutual recrimination and you know, this kind of scrupulosity and, you know, sort of public denunciation and confession. They'd just be thinking, you know, what on earth are you talking about? This is completely foreign to most people's experience, and it's totally antithetical to the gospel as well. The gospel doesn't divide humanity into the oppressed and the oppressors. It says that we're all sinful and that we all need to be forgiven by God and reconciled to one another. And like, it just goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, this is a false gospel. It's a false gospel. We should be preaching the true gospel. But chaps, I know we've only got a few
I've
minutes.
I've got to go. I've actually got to go right away. So, gentlemen, yeah. Thank you very much as always, and God bless you all. And I will. I'll see you next week.
Yeah, lots of love, Tom. Enjoy your afternoon.
Thank you. I shall.
All right. Okay, Daniel, so I think what we'll do is we'll just finish with a couple of quick emails of the week. So you listened to the pod last week, didn't you? Tom and I were having this discussion about whether or not, you know, what is actually going on with the COVID thing. Is this some kind of coordinated response to bring about ends that we are not aware of, or maybe gradually becoming aware of? Or is this purely explicable by talking about it as a basically a massive... massive amount of incompetence and so on. I mean, a friend of mine, as well as those kind of two explanations, you know, if you have, say, incompetence, you also have the idea that this is some kind of globally coordinated response. There is also a third thing, which my friend points out to me, which is that a lot of this is kind of an ideology. So that could be another way of thinking about it. Like this thing has happened. And then the response, the reason that it's kind of coordinated is because it's an ideological response to it. And that might go some way to explaining why these Western countries with sort of maybe sort of similar sort of cultures, kind of late modern Western liberal cultures, which are you know, sliding towards this kind of leftist Marxism, they're all going the same way for that.
My own sort of middle way between cock up and conspiracy is, and I've used this term a few times on this show, is to talk of hive mind.
Yeah,
you know, you can have a million termites build the most intricate structure, but they don't have any conscious necessary awareness of that.
Yeah,
like there's a few kind of queen bees.
Yeah,
but on the whole, it's and in some ways that's also a potentially quite dangerous scenario, because it's very difficult to control a hive.
Yeah.
Pull a hive back from disaster. In a conspiracy, you could presumably shut down the conspirators.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. With a hive, it's very difficult to know how to, you know, how do you address the sort of social media network which pushes and pushes what we like to hear, which is, you know, safety and arousal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I don't necessarily think that any of these explanations are mutually exclusive. I think all of these things could be true at once. Yeah. And it's quite, I mean, I don't think one can deny that there are global actors who have an ideological agenda. I mean, like whenever you mention the name Bill Gates, people start going, oh, conspiracy. But, you know, if you just Google the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you can find a list of the causes that they give literally hundreds of millions of dollars to, one of which is the BBC, one of which is the Guardian, another one of which is Imperial College London. So this is not insane. This is publicly available information. So there might be a question as to, you know, what's the point in talking about this, or whatever. Which, okay, fair enough. But it's not mad to say that there are these kind of global actors who have, you know, George Soros or you know, Klaus Schwab or whoever. They clearly are. George Soros put loads of money into Northern Ireland to get the abortion laws liberalised, for example. So there are these people who do these things. Anyway, so I know we've only got a few minutes, so let's just read some of these out. So I got a balance of responses to this. So I'm going to read two emails that reflect that. So Nicholas says, just listen to the podcast, etc. He writes, as Jesus taught, we all need forgiveness. We're all sinners. It is uncanny how alike all totalitarian, inhumane systems are. This is because all human leaders, unless blessed with a faith or a degree of humility, around the world are all drawn to the same humanistic global solutions where A, they get control, and B, God is not involved. The universality of these predilections inevitably leads to an impression that some supervening shady elite must be coordinating all the desperate and inhumane things going on. Actually, it just looks like that because they all happen to want the same things. And then he writes, interestingly, however, Jesus also talked about Satan and certainly believed in him. If we are to point to a coordinator, that leads readily to reflection on the work of Satan and demonic creatures, such as are described in C.S. Lewis's Screwtape. So, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting point, isn't it? That even if there's not a sort of human conspiracy, there certainly is a spiritual conspiracy, yeah. Which is coordinated by Satan. Yeah, yeah. I must say as well, I just listened to James Dellingpole's latest podcast with a, I think his name was, I can't remember his name, but he's basically a psychologist who through his work with schizophrenics came to believe in the reality of demon possession. It's absolutely fascinating. And, you know, it's really kind of blown my mind listening to it.
Yeah, I think Gavin Ashenden's done something similar, hasn't he, now?
Has he really? Yeah. That's interesting.
He's done a similar journey, actually, from Jungian to the more supernatural view of the world in terms of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's real, man. I've got absolutely no doubt about it. So another one here, so this is kind of coming on my more on the kind of thing I was saying. So Rowena, she writes, just listening to the debate you guys were having about is this incompetence or conspiracy, her husband's and she have not have had this debate many times. He says conspiracy, she wasn't so sure. However, what pushed me over to his side is looking into totalitarianism. I think both of you would accept that what we're seeing with the lockdowns is ideologically totalitarian, i.e. the eradication of the difference between public and private life, such that the state has overreaching control into all spheres of our lives. I would then ask, has there ever in history been the inception of a totalitarian state without conspiracy? Everything I read about or read about totalitarianism is that conspiracy is involved at every stage in the inception of the totalitarian state, in its continuation as it takes work and plotting and deception to maintain a population level delusion which is required for a totalitarian regime to function. So either this is the first time we've ever seen totalitarianism just rise up on its own through blunder and accident, or it's like every other time.
I think Lewis in The Abolition of Man picks up on this, doesn't he, that the nature of the scientific technocracy that he foresaw emerging would be particularly potent because of the scale of things. This is different from Nazism or even Napoleonic or the Roman Empire, that this has potential to scale and survey in a way that is a dictator's dream.
Yes.
And because the final abolition is of man himself, I think, as Lewis says, that the final adjustment is what we do to ourselves. We kind of existentially amputate ourselves through this process of that's what makes this milieu particularly dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think the thing for me that I find really hard to believe is not coordinated is specifically around healthcare, because it does seem to me like very, very strange things happened all at once in the same way in different nations, like the banning of hydroxychloroquine, for example, which I've heard from very, very trustworthy sources is one of the least harmful drugs on the planet and the most widely used.
I heard you say that in the
Yeah, so I find it very strange how GPs in multiple countries were simply just banned from using it for no reason at all, and many other things of that sort. But I'm willing to accept that it could be that parts of this are coordinated and parts of it aren't. It might be, as I say, I think there may be a situation whereby there are aspects of it which are coordinated and aspects of it which are
I'd had an interesting one on the Bill Gates thing. It was that he's also the product of a Silicon Valley culture, which you can see in Mark Zuckerberger and others, and quite a few prominent employees in that sphere who have who've kind of coalesced around a political worldview. And they began 20, 30 years ago as sort of supposed great libertarians, and now they swung the other way. But they also, you know, in terms of their education, are not necessarily as fully formed or informed as, you know, previous elites have been. You know, the Silicon Valley culture is a culture that's actually quite a closed bubble, really, in reality.
Yeah.
I think a good novel that picks this up is Dave Eggers' The Circle.
Yeah.
This is a Brave New World Google campus type thing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, in the end, Gates is a college dropout.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that to be anyway nasty to that, but you know, this is a person who has enormous control over tech globally. Yet, what is his knowledge base? You know, what's his philosophy? Who's taught him medical ethics?
Yeah.
Where's all that come from in his life? Has he just picked it up randomly on Wikipedia? A bit of this, a bit of that, and you know, formed his own little worldview.
Yeah, and yet he, people like him and Tony Blair speak as though they are experts in you know, in vaccines or whatever it might be. I mean, we spoke a bit about Tony Blair doing this last week, but they speak as though they know better than people with whom they disagree, who are nevertheless experts. But it's interesting stuff, Daniel, for sure. And the debate rages on. And if anyone would like to send us an email about this or anything else, you can email us at irreverendpod@gmail.com. And a reminder that you can join our Patreon community at patreon.com/irreverend if you would so like. And that's another place where you can share your views on these things. Oh, yeah. One more thing which we haven't mentioned yet is that we have, of course, our new sister podcast, which is irreverendsermonaudio.buzzsprout.com, where we just stick up one of our sermons every week. And I'm going to stick one of mine up, I think, this week. So that will be up on Friday. So irreverendsermonaudio.buzzsprout.com if you would like a sermon to listen to this weekend, hopefully for your own spiritual edification. But now I think we're probably coming to an end, and I think it'd be good to say a prayer to finish. Daniel, which one of us should pray? Should it be me or you?
I don't mind.
Do you want to lead us in prayer, Daniel?
Yeah. Why don't I do the blessing at the end of that we have at the end of services? Because I particularly in the last few months come to find this very conducive to calming my anxieties, that we preach a Christ who is both the storm but the eye of the storm also. So the peace of God which passes all understanding, keep our hearts and minds in the knowledge and love of God and of his Son Jesus Christ our Lord, and the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son and the Holy Spirit be with you and remain with you all forevermore. Amen.
Amen. Thanks so much, Daniel. And we really do mean that for our listeners. We hope that you find peace and hope through this podcast, whether you're a Christian or whether you're not sure where you are, or whether you're of another faith or no faith at all. We appreciate everyone being with us and listening to us and the wonderful feedback we get. I mean, the feedback is astonishing, really. And we just appreciate it so much. And it's such an encouragement to us. And many people say, for example, that we've helped them, but I think it's definitely true for me to say that this really has helped me over the last 7 months or however long we've been doing this to stay sane. So, you know, it's like a type of therapy, certainly for me as well. And you know, I'm sure you and you, Daniel and Tom, feel a similar way to some degree. But It's a wonderful thing to feel that sense of love and friendship and community, even if it's with mostly people who are online. You know, they're still real people. So we do really appreciate that. We appreciate everyone listening, everyone getting in touch, and thank you once again for listening this week. And we look forward to being with you again next time. And thank you, Daniel.
Take care.
All right. God bless.